Hi, this is A Way to Go, where we talk about death, dying, and the choices we face. This podcast has been created by Dignity SA, a non-profit organization with a vision for South Africa, where all of us are supported through life's final journey with compassionate care, dignity, and the freedom to choose our own path. Dignity SA, our lives, our choices. Welcome to the shortened micro version of A Way to Go, still complete in itself, but you can listen to the extended macro version, about double the length, with added depth and nuance and extra fascinating details and more stories when you join Dignity South Africa for free, which gives you full access to a range of unique digital content and events. So, whether you want to sign up as a member or you're looking for more information about palliative care, advanced directives, withholding and withdrawing life-giving support, or our campaign to legalize assisted dying, please visit dignitysouthafrica.org. Although membership of Dignity South Africa is free, we do rely upon your donation to help support our campaigns to provide the end-of-life options you might want for yourself and your loved ones, which you can read about in our latest newsletter, Dignity Matters, that's also on our website. My name is Sean O'Connor. Thanks so much for being here to join this national and global conversation about assisted dying. And in this episode, to share in the utterly remarkable journey of a friend called Pi, who traveled all the way to Switzerland to help their partner to fulfill their choice to access medically assisted dying. In the macro version available to our members, you could actually pause right here and go to our website to register and listen. It takes less than a minute. You'll hear more about why they chose the organization they did, as well as a beautiful story about something that happened at their hotel on the way and other details from their experience, including what happened after the death. Here's Pi.
So for context, Una and I, we met in 2016 and developed a relationship, and that was like really, really wonderful. And, in retrospect, she was already kind of like, a bit ill then. And it's something she's had her whole life, which we later found out was MECFS.
Okay. What does that stand for?
Myalgic encephalomyelitis or chronic fatigue syndrome. So it's just called ME/CFS. But people are trying to use the name ME rather than CFS because with chronic fatigue syndrome, it makes it sound like, oh, you're just a bit tired. Or it's stress. It's like sometimes being called yuppie flu and things like that.
Right.
It's a much more serious multi-system disease. Usually it's something you kind of like progressively have your entire life, but it progresses from mild to moderate to severe to very severe and extremely severe even. And so, when we met, it's like, she'd occasionally have episodes where she crashed. We didn't really understand it or think more of it at the time.
Right.
So we were doing lots of things. And then in 2019 is when she started getting much more ill. That's where she became severe.
Mm-hmm.
And where she became bedbound. Yeah, it was... It was very rough because, especially because the disease tends to have this dynamic known as PEM, post-exertional malaise, where any unusual exertion tends to trigger it, but it usually tends to happen with a bit of a time delay, like 24 to 48 hours. So if you go do something, then you might, like exercise, you might feel a bit, go for a walk and feel better, and then suddenly the next day you crash with flu systems, malaise, headaches, just kind of like a worsening of all symptoms. So it was back and forth and just not understanding what was going on for a long time until we actually found out about ME/CFS, which Una actually found out by watching this documentary called Unrest.
Yeah, you mentioned that she came across it on Netflix, is that right?
Yeah, and then, she was watching this and just kind of like flabbergasted. It's like, this is what happening to me. And that's really was the start of kind of like, you know, researching the condition, figuring out how to manage it, how to treat it.
Is it a progressive disease that will result in morbidity?
Usually, yeah. You know, ME/CFS is one of those conditions where most people are severe. They are too sick to go to hospital, which sounds like it's a thing, you know, like a contradiction in terms, because if you're sick, you go to a hospital. But it's like, no, with ME/CFS, it's like there's a level of illness where you cannot go to a hospital because no hospitals know how to take care of this disease.
Wow.
And, you know, when people get severe, things like sensory sensitivities can become so bad that, you know, things like noise can trigger a severe crash, or in some cases like seizures even. So a lot of, you know, management at home is about like maintaining an environment that is, you know, quiet, dark, insulated, you know, right humidity, right temperature.
Wow.
It is things that are, you know, it's very specific.
And so were you the primary caregiver?
Yeah. So that kind of like became my life. It became a case of like I was working, you know, and aside from that, just taking care of her mostly. And that's sort of like where all my energy and attention went.
Sure.
And like, you know, researching medication, treatments.
So what led you to your decision to travel to Switzerland and seek an alternative?
I guess the story of that actually goes back a bit further, in the sense that, you know, we were both already, you know, even before we met, supporters of medical aid in dying.
Okay.
Because, you know, we both have our own kind of like stories with members of our family having had really bad deaths. In my case, you know, my grandmother and later my mom had really bad, you know, unnecessarily bad deaths, where medical aid and dying would really have been a more sensible option.
I'm sorry.
To avoid unnecessary suffering. And, and so, you know, with the ME/CFS, as stuff got worse, you know, there would be times when Una would just lose hope about how difficult it is to deal with. And because she was very much trying to fight it, but like when it gets bad, it gets really bad. And so, you know, sometimes she would talk about just wishing the suffering could end, really. And so it's something we talked about on and off, not as something to really necessarily action yet, but kind of like, you know, we had this general understanding that, you know, we're fighting this condition, we're hoping for potentially recovery, for a cure, but we also know that, you know, with the research, that the picture doesn't look good. And you know, we had this understanding that at some point, if stuff just becomes too bad, she would want to exercise that option, if at all possible. You know, because one of the things with ME/CFS is you can get sick to a point where travel becomes impossible. Because we knew that if you wanted to do something like this and travel, she would have to still be well enough to do that. It was very much her agency and her kind of like idea of kind of like, you know, I want to have this option if it gets bad enough. Because she doesn't want, you know, she doesn't want to go through how bad ME can get. It's really, really bad. You know, ME/CFS is one of those conditions that almost, that there's no bottom to the disease in terms of how bad it can get. You know, you can be like, you know, bed bound and unable to move and sort of like, you know, having literally no life. And that is still very good compared to some people when you start getting extremely severe.
Sure.
So Una was only sort of like between sort of like severe and very severe, depending on the you know, that's sort of like the, from where she fluctuated on in terms of the illness level.
So once you make that kind of decision, then you are starting to look at what agency you may have left and how long you will have to travel and those types of, you know, practical concerns, I guess.
Yeah. So the turning point was at more or less the beginning of 2023. That's when Una actually reached the point where she said it's, you know, after a particularly bad crash and a particularly long crash where she was just like, I'm done. I want to look at assisted dying for real now. And we had that talk and, you know, she told me that. And, you know, I remember that because that for me was like a very heavy thing to hear, because, you know, at that point, it's, you know, all my energy was oriented towards taking care of her and hoping for a cure, researching stuff. And it's like a very big gear shift there, where you know that, okay, now we are shifting gears towards a good death. And then, you know, trying to research all the practicalities of actually exercising that or doing that or using medical aid in dying. And, you know, because it's not, it's an imposing thing. It's, there's not really like much of a manual for it.
Okay.
And so there was kind of like, you know, researching about options there. You know, we knew about Dignitas in Switzerland, but we did some research and found out about some of the alternative organizations as well. And
all based in Switzerland.
Yeah. Yeah, because Switzerland is the only country that allows medical aid in dying for non-citizens.
Right.
There are some new ones since then, but at the time, Pegasus, they looked like the best option.
Was cost a factor as well?
Yeah, definitely, because it is, I mean, it's maybe not the most expensive thing by European standards, but by South African standards, it's certainly expensive. It's one of those things where, you know, it's hundreds of thousands. So we're very privileged to be able to afford that, because, you know, I think it's a sad reality that, you know, most people in South Africa cannot. It's just completely financially out of reach.
Yeah.
And it's one reason why, you know, it's important to make that accessible here in South Africa, I think, because, you know, you shouldn't have to go to Switzerland just to have agency over your own death.
Yeah. So can you tell us about life together leading up to that flight?
Yeah. So ironically, you know, this is one of those things where sometimes having clarity about your end can be one of the things that brings you to life. Because I think even though the condition was bad, and I mean, ME/CFS is always bad. It's like a, you know, it's a canvas of bad that you can paint a bit of good on sometimes. But that year, because it took about a year and a half to make this happen, by the way, just in terms of, you know, there's a lot of admin and paperwork and just practical things like getting a passport when you're too ill to go to Home Affairs. But in that year, I think, since she had the clarity that, okay, there is an end in sight, in many ways, I think that really, really helped her peace and her, you know, her, how would you say, her...
peace of mind?
Yeah, and her...
her spirit.
Her calm and serenity, I think. Because it's one of those things where before this, there's this thing of kind of like, it's almost like you're stuck in a vice that is just getting tighter and tighter and there's no end in sight. That's a lot how ME/CFS feels. And, you know, you lose contact with friends, family, hobbies, everything you used to do, everything you used to love. Your life just keeps shrinking. And in that year following that, you know, she was able to actually find a lot of peace and find, you know, push through the, like the bad times weren't as bad anymore because you knew that they're not forever. And we could appreciate the good times and the good time, you know, good days a lot more. And we could actually work through kind of like, you know, almost like her bucket list. Because she had, you know, she had a list of things that she wanted to do before she died.
Okay.
And so we started doing that. And so, you know, we're having conversations with friends and family and, you know, people came to visit and say hi and sort of like, you know, spend a bit of time together. You know, she started the process of saying goodbye to things. And that was very special. And it was kind of like a thing of like, you know, making peace with everything. And, you know, it culminated in early 2024 because we eventually got the date for May 2024 is when we had the date for at Pegasus in Switzerland, and you know, so a bit before that, we actually had a sort of like a living wake, and you know, lots and lots of other friends just came to say goodbye, basically, and to celebrate her life.
Wow, how moving!
And that was extremely special because it's all these. All these people that she's had an impact on, because she's had an impact on many, many lives, who could come and show appreciation and say goodbye and also say that they understand why she's doing this.
Wow. Listening to you, I get the sense that you described the year before as one of immense darkness. And this one, subsequent to that decision, feels like she was letting in the light in a way. and, you know, making space for light to come, enlightening and preparing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of that has to do with, I think, you know, just that peace and serenity of knowing that the suffering isn't forever.
Mm.
And that there's, in this case, it might sound strange to say, but like that there's light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, there's like a known destination.
Yeah, there's and the fact that she can have agency over that.
Yeah.
In the sense of, you know, choose to go, you know, to go on her own terms, in her own timeline. And while she's well enough to do it with, you know, with dignity, with her head held high, and not in, you know, completely in the depths of suffering, that is something that is very powerful. And it gave her that resolve to push through everything to get there.
Hmm.
And even though, you know, there's of course a lot of grieving and sadness with dying, especially having experienced and been around bad deaths, the gift of a good death, it cannot be overstated. I think it's so important.
Okay.
I think, yeah, being able to just have that agency means so much.
Mm. Can you tell us about the journey?
Yeah, so... So at this point, you know, she was pretty much wheelchair bound, and so managed to navigate the, you know, getting from the airport to the bus to various other places to eventually get to Basel. Yeah, so eventually we managed to get to the hotel, and there's a specific hotel that that Pegasus uses.
And it's, is it open to the public as well? Is it like just a regular hotel?
Yeah, it's just a regular hotel. You know, they have an understanding.
Right.
With Pegasus. Lovely hotel with lovely people. And, you know, so we met there with Una's parents because they also came through. So her mom and her dad came through to also see her off because they both live internationally now.
Sure.
And so we spent that time together. And... yeah, that was kind of like the process of traveling there. And
so then tell us about the last day or the next morning.
What happened? Yeah, so the next morning we went and there's a driver that met us from Pegasus because they have a facility that they go to, but that they, you know, there's like they don't advertise the location of that.
Okay.
And specifically, when we were doing the research, they still had an older location somewhere inside Basel. I think it's like somewhere in the city, but they had just started sort of like setting up this new location. But the new location is also out in the Swiss countryside, and it's absolutely beautiful. That was sort of like a welcome surprise because we didn't know upfront that it's going to be there.
Hmm.
But the new place was just literally kind of like, you know, fairy tale beautiful.
Hmm.
We drove there, you know, went inside, and they have this sort of like a bed facing this big window looking out over the countryside, and it was just sort of like, you know, these emerald green fields and sort of like cows browsing around, and then like a forest in the background, and then like mountains, and then the clouds over the top of that, and it was sure. It was an absolutely beautiful view.
And were Una's parents with you at this time also?
Yes, yeah. So they came with. They met us at the hotel in the morning.
Okay.
And, yeah, so when she got settled in, you know, I was, like, doing, you know, the final paperwork and chatting to the folks there. And the facility was really beautiful. It was clean, neat, very comfortable, very welcoming.
Hmm.
It felt like the place had sort of like, you know, very much the appropriate just respect, I guess, for ending your life there. Like it wasn't, like it was clean, but not like clinical.
Gotcha, yeah.
You had a sense of sort of like, okay, this is a nice place. And we had pretty much, I think, you know, kind of like the day. So it's not, you know, there's not a rushed schedule or anything. It's okay. Like when you go there, it's kind of like, you know, you settle in the morning. You have a couple of hours just to make sure all the final paperwork is in order.
So there must be a reception area or another office to do that in? And then this room you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
So there's a little side room where you do all that stuff. And then there's the, you know, and then they start sort of like, you know, getting things ready there. They have a nurse there. And he was a really lovely person as well. So they install an IV.
Okay.
Because some places with MID, they use the substance that you drink.
Okay.
Pegasus, they use an IV.
All right.
Because then you don't have to deal with potential things like nausea and whatnot.
Okay.
And so what they do is they put the IV in place first, you know, just with saline. And they don't, you know, put the medication in yet. And then, you know, they give you some time just to do any last things you need to do. So they kind of like let you be with your family. You know, we talked a bit. Una recorded the last installment of her little vlog that she was keeping, because she, in the run-up to this, she started recording a vlog on YouTube of like her last 30 days. It didn't end up recording every day, but it's like, you know, she has her story that she recorded her, you know.
Is it still up there?
And it's still up there, yeah. So
how does one find it?
If you look on YouTube for Una Carlson, you should find it.
Okay.
And specifically just her last 30 days.
Okay.
Has the installments there. And, yeah. And then the last one we recorded on her deathbed at the Pegasus facility. And, yeah, it doesn't show the view, unfortunately. It just shows her, because one of the things that, you know, the founder of Pegasus, like, told us or requested is that, you know, it's like we can share photos and things like that, but nothing that could identify the location of the facility.
Okay. So Una's on her bed, and you and her folks are standing around her.
Yeah. Yeah, and so we recorded that last bit, went through a few last things, and then sort of like, you know, when we were ready, we were saying, you know, she was like, okay, yes, ready now. And yeah, so then they, you know, come back in. They swap the medication, so from the saline to the mixture that they use. Yeah, and then the process from there is they have a video camera to record it, you know, for their own kind of like purposes, because you have to sort of like know that the person consents. So they tell you up front, it's like, you know, the moment of your death will be recorded for you if necessary, you know, because they have that as evidence. You know, a lot of boxes you have to tick
right
to have everything be above board.
Yeah.
And it's very critical that the patient has to trigger the mechanism themselves. You can't do it on their behalf.
Okay.
And so they can, you know, they can prepare the medication, but then, Una has to state on the video that she understands what this is going to do.
Right.
And then trigger it herself. You know, there's a thing that,
like a button, a device of some sort.
Yeah, it's this kind of like roly thing that they use usually to, you know, when you have a drip and it can sort of it rolls closed.
Yes.
Yeah, it opens and closes. Gotcha. It's like a tap, basically.
Right.
So they show her how the tap works, and it's sort of like, okay, you know, when she's ready, she has to open the tap.
I see.
And so, you know, she has that. And then so when she was ready, the way she wanted to go is, you know, with her, one of her favorite songs. And so, you know, we were standing around with her and I was holding her hand. She played her song, which was Insomnia by Underworld. And Insomnia, I think, is a song like lifelong. It resonated with her with kind of like the struggle of Emmy, of not being able to find proper rest. And and so she ended up playing the song, opening the tap, and then, you know, singing along to those lyrics, you know, until the medication took effect and she just drifted off and fell asleep.
Wow.
And
you've described that as a good death.
And you know, I think that's a good way to go, saying goodbye, looking at each other, singing her song. And yeah.
Absolutely. Would we all have deaths like that? That's amazing. I mean, irrespective of whatever she'd experienced up to that point, to have that way to connect with you in love and leave this realm like that is just extraordinary. I'm so glad that you were there with her and you can share the story, because it's really beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was really beautiful, and I was really glad that, you know, I could give her that and enable that and be part of that journey. Not just the journey itself, but, you know, the journey's end. And it was peaceful, even though it was very sad. It's like, I think because we had done so much, you know, grieving work up until then, it was not like all the grief was there at once. I mean, Emmy, just the disease itself, there's this whole concept in Emmy support groups of ambiguous grief, where folks have to grieve the parts of their lives that they lose and no longer have access to, even though you're not dying, but you have death, you have to grieve as if you're dying, because Emmy is almost like you're progressively dying bit by bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've already at that point spent 5 years going through the stages of the sort of like, you know, progressive grief and ambiguous grief. And then especially having that last year of being able to say goodbye to things and consciously prepare, that really helped, I think, to soften the blow in terms of, it's not like I fell apart after that. But there was definitely a complicated mix of emotions. You know, there's sadness, there's reflection on all the things that we never got to do, but there's also serenity and gratitude that we managed to make this happen and give her a death that is so much better than it could have been. And that in some cases, you know, we avoided the jaws of how bad Emmy can get. And I think that there's a lot of gratitude in that, sort of thankfulness and serenity.
And we're going to leave it there. Remember to visit dignitysouthafrica.org, where you can register as a member for free to access the extended macro version to learn more about what happened in Switzerland for Pi and Una. Please also contact us via the website if you're thinking of sharing your story about end-of-life choices or their lack. We'd love to be in touch with you. Maybe we can feature your experience right here in the show as a homage, perhaps as part of an extended eulogy, or to just add to the many voices calling for a change in our legislation. Join us. Until next time, if there is one, please spread the word that talking about death is good for life. Adios.